We have a quorum, so we'll get started here this morning. Presentations primarily regarding the Emerald Ash Borer. And I'm advised we need to have an approval of the minutes from January 23. Somebody look
so,
at those.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lisbegard has moved approval of the minutes January 23. Is any comments, questions, discussion on that? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. We've got quite a list of presenters here today, so we'll try and roll along to the best of our ability. First on the agenda, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Please be seated and introduce yourself for the record as you're getting ready to speak there, please. And
Mr. Chair,
proceed.
I'm Angie Amborn, and I am the supervisor for the pest detection and export certification in the Plant Protection Division with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Okay. I'll go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Alexa Stoneth. I am the legislative coordinator at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Good morning, Chair and members. Forrest Dole, Director of Forestry with Minnesota DNR.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, so I'm just going to give you a brief, just quick overview of the different roles that our agency plays in regards to Emerald Ash Borer on this interagency team. So the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, we are in charge of regulating the movement of materials that can vector Emerald Ash Borer. And so for those of you that aren't familiar, we're going to call it EAB. Is everybody in agreement with that? Okay. All right, and we are also in charge of the detection and tracking of EAB. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is in charge of managing state forests and then the reforestation efforts, and they are also supporting community forestry efforts. And then the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, they're determining the proper wood waste use and our disposal options. All right, so today I'm just going to give you a brief overview of EAB biology, the distribution, and the spread. All right, so let's start with a little bit of EAB biology. For those of you that are not familiar, Emerald Ash Borer is a wood-boring beetle that was first discovered in Minnesota in 2009. It's from China. It was first discovered in the United States in 2002. Emerald ash borer feeds on all species of ash, and if you're not familiar, in Minnesota we have approximately 1 billion ash trees, so we do have a large stake in the presence of this insect. The insect kills trees by the larvae tunneling underneath the bark, and so in effect what it does is it cuts off the tree's ability to transport nutrients and water, and that's how it kills the trees. When EAB populations are low, signs and symptoms are virtually unnoticeable. But when the populations explode and grow very rapidly, we can have, that's when the damage really becomes noticeable. And for those of you that have those slides, you can see that street that's pretty much, the trees are all dead and it's bare. All right, so what happens is populations of emerald ash borer typically grow slowly at first, and then they grow exponentially. And so tree mortality lags a little bit behind, and it follows behind that. But then what can happen is you can have large amounts of trees that all die in a very short period of time. EAB does travel minimally on its own, but one of the key vectors that we deal with every day is firewood, and that's typically moved by humans. All right, so this is where we are nationally with the distribution of emerald ash borer. So most states east of Minnesota have pretty large infestations of emerald ash borer. However, you can see here that the good news is that EAB spread has been a little bit slower in Minnesota as compared to the national average. So you can see that top line is the percent of counties that are infested over time, and that's the national average. And then Minnesota is that red line that is on the bottom. And we like to think that one of the reasons that some of the spread has been slow is because of outreach. And that's been one of our key components for helping to slow the spread of emerald ash borer, and specifically our Don't Move Firewood campaign. Another key component of our program has been our work with communities. And specifically what we do is we train communities and cities and municipalities on how to find EAB and how to survey for EAB and detect it as soon as possible so that they can begin their management as soon as they find it. All right, so I know everyone has been wondering about the cold, right? And since it has been really cold. So the cold does play a factor. And probably is helping keep that spread slow in Minnesota. One thing to remember, though, is that the cold is not a cure for emerald ash borer, and the populations can rebound, and they can rebound pretty quickly. So in Minnesota, EAB has been documented in 17 of our 87 counties and approximately 66 cities. So if you look at the state as a whole, EAB has still yet to impact a large, has not impacted a large percentage of our state yet. And one of the things that we have coming up from our perspective is that the federal government is considering deregulating EAB at the federal level, and so then the state will have to decide what the state programs can continue on. So the Department of Ag has been meeting with stakeholders and our partners to discuss what we're going to do and what our options are when the federal government bows out. And with that, I will turn it over to Forrest, unless there's any questions.
Question here. Representative Guineas.
Why would the federal government back out?
So federal quarantines, one of the reasons that they're doing that, right, is the federal funding is drying up. And quarantines, you know, once an insect has gotten or an invasive species has gotten so far, it's not containable across the, you know, across its range. Look how fast it's spread, like in comparison to gypsy moth. And so that's part of the reason. And I think a lot of it has to do with just general funding. Does that answer your question?
So it's basically a choice just because deregulation is cool. Okay, thank you.
Good to go. Mr. Chair, members, again, for the record, my name is Forrest Bowe, Director of Forestry. And in this part of the presentation, we hope to highlight some of the issues facing Minnesota's ash forests, our community forests, and the citizens, and update the committee on what ENR is doing and what we need to do in the future. As Angie stated, there's nearly a billion ash trees here in Minnesota. On average, one out of five trees in our communities are ash. So a lot of communities, nearly 3 million ash trees line the boulevards, the parking lots, and yards in our Minnesota communities. You can see by the graphic, you can probably even pick out your community. So there's two things depicted here. One is kind of where our ash forests are in the state and the density of those ash forests, and also just the amount of ash in various communities. So there's, as you can see, there's a lot of our communities that have up to 60% ash trees in those community forests. And if you put it in actual terms of the number of trees, Brainerd has some 7,000 ash trees in the community. Duluth has 51,000 ash trees. If you look at Brooklyn Park, they probably got over 45,000 ash trees. And in Virginia, It's 36.2% of the trees in that community are ash, really something over 9,300 ash trees. That's a lot of ash trees that these communities are going to have to deal with. And certainly left untreated, ash will die. The level of ash that we're going to be losing will be very significant and similar to what we experienced with Dutch elm disease in the 1970s. And like ash today, elm was a large part of our community forest. But unlike ash, elm was only a minor component in our forested landscape, where really ash dominates a lot of our cover types in the forest. Communities are certainly at the greatest risk and are in the greatest immediate need of attention. Many communities don't know where their ash are, how many they have, they don't have an ash management plan, and they're really unsure of the work that needs to be done with ash. And ultimately, they have very limited capacity to do any work once they know what needs to be done. We've heard from communities that they need technical assistance, they need to know what tools they have available, from treating ash to removing it once those ash trees are dead and dying, and then, of course, how to take care of the new trees once we get new trees established in those communities. And the ash management plans lay out that timeline and what needs to be done. You know, really, if communities don't have that needed financial and technical assistance, they'll have a lot of things on their hands. And that's where the agencies can come in, try to help them, assist them. Ultimately, from a state forest perspective, we see the communities as kind of our first line of defense. They're the first line that would save our ash forests. And of course, there's a lot of ramifications should we have large ash die-off in the forested areas. Some communities have tried to treat emerald ash borer, treat the trees, because they really can't keep up with the removals. It's dying so fast. And treatments allow for slowing the spread, delaying the removals, and saving a lot of the ecosystem functions that the ash provide. You'll hear a lot more from the other testifiers on specifics about the costs and implications, but I just want to prime that pump a little bit here right now. The average cost for treating an ash tree is around $120 to $200 to treat a tree, and it's good for maybe 2 to 3 years. The average cost to remove a tree is $1,000 for a community. And if you think about a person that lives in the community, a homeowner, they may be paying $1,000 to $4,000 to remove that ash tree in their yard. So things are going to get costly very quick.
A couple of questions if you're good to take them here.
Absolutely.
During your presentation. First I have Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to any of the testifiers, but I think specifically to Mr. Bowe, a couple of questions. One is, you know, do you believe that we can stop it? That's one of the big things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, do we believe we can stop it? No, we do not. We can slow it down, but this pest will kill all of our ash trees.
Okay. Representative Green. I was around during the Dutch elm stuff, and it seemed to take us by surprise, but really we saw it coming and weren't prepared for it. And I always wondered, because I was down here during that time in the metro area, and we were cutting these elm trees, and they were big and they were beautiful. But then when they replanted with all the same species again, which didn't really make a lot of sense to me, and now we're seeing another problem. But there's two things that I'd like to, you know, maybe you don't have the answers to today, but, you know, in the communities, even where it hasn't reached yet, it would be incumbent to go in now and start taking out some of the mature trees, if they could be sawed for logs, because ash is beautiful wood. or you know, or burned or whatever, however you have to get rid of it, and start transplanting now before the rest gets there. The other is a personal kind of question that I have, and to see if you know the answer. There's very few elm trees left from that, but I know of one in particular that is towers above the rest of the forest where it sits, and it's always the most lush green tree there, and it has a huge eagle's nest in it, and at the base of that tree is nothing but the bones of the animals that the eagles have eaten and dropped down there. Is there anything that you know of that would cause that? Is there something in the bone marrow, or is there something that's preventing the disease from taking that tree? Because it obviously, to the layman, looks like that eagle saved that tree.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, well, you're absolutely right. We need to be prepared, and we need to have a much more diverse forest, whether that's our community forest or whether that's our northern ash forest. We need to promote diversity in those. And we have learned from the past. Maybe it took us a couple times, which is unfortunate, but I don't believe we'll be making that mistake again. We need to have more diversity in our community forest. With regard to that elm, you will hear a little bit about some research that's taking place. I don't want to, certainly not an expert, but there are some disease-resistant elm that they've been doing research on, trying to develop that particular species. And then we also know, just in nature, there's some that are more resilient than others, and I think that's what you've probably come across in that case. So,
fair to say, Representative Green, that eagle ain't hurting the tree any.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I come from the city of Minnetonka, where I was on the city council for a number of years, and we were addressing emerald ash borer several years ago in trying to be proactive about having an EAB management plan. And I think the relation or the comparison to Dutch elm disease, and I think in many suburban communities, we lost all our Dutch elm and truly replanted them all with ash. And so in trying to be proactive, and it hasn't been officially identified yet in Minnetonka, though it's all around us, so I'm sure it's there and we just haven't found it. But trying to be proactive, we've identified areas to take it down where if it died and fell would become a hazard. And so looking at things and determining or rating how important it is to take care of them or to remove them, excuse me. And so I think being proactive has been super helpful for the city of Minnetonka, and I think for other cities it would serve as well. Are you working directly with cities to set up a plan or help them set up a plan to be proactive instead of having to be reactive when we need to then go in for dead trees and instead looking to you know, catch them when we can or before? We even have crews going out that will cut trees at a reduced cost trying to because they can have all equipment there, and it's cheaper for them to do a bunch at a time. So anyway, just wondering if you're working to help cities be proactive.
Mr. Bull.
Chair Purcell and Representative Akin, we are trying to be very proactive, but I think what you'll hear today from the communities is that there just isn't enough technical assistance and there isn't enough funding to get ahead of the game that and take care of, you know, doing that inventory, providing the resources to be proactive in maybe taking some trees down or even to treat trees, because that's part of the mix here too, really wanting to preserve as many as we can so that we prolong this effort, right? And otherwise it's going to take a lot of financial resources up front.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Just add to this, we've got some testifiers coming later on here that are going to add to this conversation, so I'll just advise that let's have our questions now, a few of them, and then we'll move along. Representative Guineas.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you talked about treatment of trees and it was relatively inexpensive to removing them, tell us about the treatment. Is it neonicotinoids? Because they're very profound unintended consequences, and are you measuring that cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenis, I believe the treatment is not a neonicotinoid, and I think there's some other folks that are going to be able to speak to that here in a couple of minutes.
I can speak to that also, Mr. Chair. So most communities, or a lot of communities, are using the emamectin benzoate, and that's actually isolated from a soil bacterium. And then there's another product called azadractin that is an organic anti-feeding deterrent that's from the neem tree. And so those are some of the products that are being used, and those are not neonicotinoids. And so they don't have the pollinator effects.
Well, I should have, instead of said of neonics, I should have said systemic pesticides. Are either the other two systemics or are non-systemic?
The two that I just mentioned, yes, they are systemic. They're injected into the tree. So they're not, the way that the action of those pesticides, they go into, the insecticides, they go into the tree and they're taken up versus like some of the neonicotinoids that are soil drenches, those will also go in, so those are the ones that will go into the grass and those can get into the flowers, but these ones specifically go directly into the tree and then they're taken up through the vascular.
If I could. So do you know about, if they're taken up by the tree and can get into the tree, are there unintended consequences for pollinators because they're systemic?
So, Representative Genius, Mr. Chair, so right now there's not a lot of research. The research that is out there suggests that there's very little unintended consequences, especially to pollinators. So pollinators typically are not feeding on the phloem. They're not feeding on actual the leaves of the tree. And there's a study that there's very few pollinators. I believe it was Kamal Gandhi's study. There's very few that are actually feeding on the flowers. There's a few flies, I believe, that feed on the flowers, but there's very few pollinators that are actually using that ash resource to date.
Couple more here. Representative Luke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for Director Bo. As I understood you, you basically indicated that the way this is going to work, or at least the way it appears it's going to work based on what's happened east of us, is this is going to take the same track as Dutch elm. Literally, I think you used the words, it's going to kill all our ash trees. I don't doubt that's probably where we're headed. So do we have a legitimate strategy here that is, if you're going to accept that right now we're going to lose 99% of the ash trees to deal with that rather than spend a whole lot of time trying to save them? Are we going to admire this problem and manage it and still end up ultimately with no ash trees, or we have a strategy here to cut our losses and not expand unnecessary funds? Because we got a Minnesota problem here, and I don't think we can continue to admire it and manage it. We unless we can come up with a way to stop it, then we better back up and look at how we cut our losses, and that means, sadly, we're going to lose a lot of ash trees even before they're infected. I mean, what's the grand strategy here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Luke, we do have a grand strategy, and it is really multifaceted. You're going to hear from the PCA in a minute that there's issues with what do we do with all of the dead material because we can't handle it all. We've got strategies that we need to employ working with communities. DNR has a urban and community forest program where we can provide that network of foresters that we already have out there and lend the technical assistance so that a community can be prepared and develop an ash management plan. Again, the strategy isn't one single thing. There is no silver bullet. We will lose ash, but the idea is to prolong this such that all of those financial burdens don't come at one time. And it's a multifaceted step. And so I think you'll hear in a few minutes about what communities are looking for. We have this program that we're able to assist. The communities certainly need some financial and technical support to do what they do. Last year, we got some one-time funding from the U.S. Forest Service. We had $109,000 that the Forest Service gave us, and we invested that into a grant program to help some communities. We had over 100 communities apply for that limited amount of money. Their applications totaled $2.4 million. And so that's, you can kind of get to see what the need is out there. Just wanted to, you know, for everyone to understand that we have a program in place, we have a grant program in place. Communities will need some assistance to pull all of this off. I want to share my time a little bit with my silviculture coordinator so that he can talk specifically about what's happening in our ash forests. I've spent most of my time talking about the communities, but I think I'm going to invite Mike Reineken up here so that he can talk a little bit more about what's happening in the ash forests.
Mr. Bull, I've got two more questions, and then I'm gonna ask members to hold off so we can get the presentations done. We're going to run out of time. No two ways about it. So, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Director Bowe, first of all, let me say I'm glad to see Forrest is back in the forest. So, and this might be for Mr. Reineken coming up. I'm just curious to know, particularly in the southeastern part of the state where we've already got the emerald ash borer, what are you doing with the commercial logging community down there, you know, in order to increase the stumpage? Have you reduced the price that they would pay for the stumpage? And then, of course, what are the uses for the ash? Obviously, if it's small, it's basically firewood. But what are the commercial uses that can be applied to the ash stands as they currently are?
Mr. Ball.
Chairman Purcell, Representative Fabian, we're trying to utilize more ash just overall in the state. We want to try to get ahead of the game. We want to harvest, be more aggressive with our ash harvest so we can be more thoughtful and replace those ash stands. At least in the southern part of the state, I think most of those communities are playing a little catch-up, that ash is already dead. And once it's dead, it's really only a firewood component. Otherwise, you know, we can develop, we can sell ash, and it can be used for paneling or pallets or a lot of different things. But there's a lot of other species out there that our industry is more interested in. And so we want to make sure that they have ample opportunity to help us get that ash managed. We're putting more ash on the market in order to drive that market.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I'm just curious, how does this fit into the plan that came out last year with regards to the cap on the amount of stumpage? Are you going to exceed that if there's a market for taking some of the ash?
Chairman Purcell, Representative Fabian, in our sustainable timber harvest analysis, we had decided to offer 870,000 cords per year. But in addition to that, we had a 30,000 cord ash and tamarack initiative. And you may recall that the tamaracks is under the same kind of threat with a pest. And the idea is to more aggressively manage those two species, get more of that wood off the landscape, utilize the wood before it's dead and dying, get it to the mill, and then be more thoughtful about reforesting those areas. So we do have a very aggressive ash and tamarack initiative to try to get ahead of the game.
Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually looking forward to asking Mr. Bowe questions from Representative Bowe, but actually I'm going to pass because my questions have been covered already, so thank you.
Thank you very much. So let's proceed now as... introduce yourself for the record here, please.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Mike Reineken. I'm the silviculture coordinator with DNR Division of Forestry. My program is responsible for reforestation across the state, planting, seeding, tending trees until they're free to grow. So Our director spoke of the primary issue we've identified so far, that's in the communities. I'd like to speak to the other large part of this story, which is our ash forest resource. You'll also hear about this from Dr. Rob Slazak from the Minnesota Forest Resource Council to come. So Minnesota's ash forests are pretty unique in size and composition. There's no other state that has an ash forest as large and as widely distributed as Minnesota's. Unlike states to the east where ash is mostly a minor component of mixed hardwoods, Minnesota has a million acres of cover type that's dominated by ash and almost primarily ash. This means we can learn some things from Michigan, Wisconsin, New England, but we're really in uncharted territory here. So just some numbers to give you perspective on ash in Minnesota. It's the second most common tree genus, second only to Aspen's genus. Statewide, there's over 1.2 billion ash trees. That's of 2017. It dominates a million acres, as I mentioned. Minnesota DNR is responsible for 170,000 of those acres. There was a question about what's going on in the southeast where emerald ash borer has been around a little bit longer. In the southeast, we have more mixed forests, but ash is a component. Our forest health specialists, they have an aerial detection program, and they estimate there's 200,000 acres of forest that have already been impacted in the southeast. Next slide. So ash is ecologically the best suited species to grow on these wet sites where it dominates. It's really a keystone species here. Without ash intercepting and using water, these forested wetlands that are dominated by ash would be something else, something either dominated by shrubs or cattails, but not forest. The additional water not intercepted or evaporated by these trees will not remain on our land. It moves and will impact others as it does. These ash forests are also vital to plants and wildlife. You'll hear about that a little bit later. It offers unique habitat that's not found anywhere else in the state. So for me and for the DNR and a lot of other landowners, reforestation is going to be a big issue. We have a million acres of ash. What's going to replace that when EAB kills most of it? From regional research, we know that there's several non-ash species that may grow and survive on these wet sites. And Rob will be talking about that a little bit later. We need more information and trials to determine other reforestation techniques. So as we look to a future without ash, it's important that we're thoughtful about reforestation to ensure these ash forests are replaced with native trees, not invasive species, and that we'll be successful replacements on the landscape. So timber harvest is a tool that we use to create growing conditions to favor establishing non-ash species. There's some limitations there. Some have already come up. But harvests, they have to be designed carefully in these forests because ash trees keep the water table in check and support these forested wetlands. Economics will also play a role. They'll make it difficult to use harvest to favor species that will replace ash due to low volume of wood on these sites and currently low demand. There's a serious need to develop markets to utilize ash wood. Additionally, the wet nature of ash forests require frozen ground for timber harvest to take place. Frozen soil conditions may occur more infrequently and with shorter duration as our winters warm. So that really shortening and sometimes closing the window for harvest and our opportunity to get non-ash species established on these sites. So all of these factors taken together mean it's very challenging to manage ash forests sustainably. Nevertheless, DNR has a mission to sustain these forests, brace for EAB mortality, and renew damaged acres, thereby maintaining ecological and economic benefits. So EAB is not currently established at a level in our forested areas to the north where any management tools have been taken off the table, such as harvest, planting, and seeding. DNR's ash forest management goals are to keep these forested sites forested, maintaining hydrologic function, and minimizing impact to habitat and diversity. Our sustainable timber harvest came up already. Our targets have called for an increase in ash harvest, as mentioned. Harvest can create conditions that favor non-ash species. Increased harvest can allow us to get ahead of the beetle. At the same time, we hope to get ash on the market in advance of dying ash forests. So to have timber harvest as a management tool, strengthened markets are needed to utilize ash wood. Further, we need to continue to build our knowledge base with formal and informal observation, particularly of reforestation techniques, which non-ash species will survive and grow to potentially replace ash, and how do we get those trees established. So DNR is managing the ash forest on state land for ecosystem health and benefits, such as hydrologic function. We want to keep forested sites forested and minimize negative impacts to biodiversity. So that kind of concludes the second part of DNR's presentation, and I'll hand it off to Alexis Donath from MPCA.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bavian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. DNR, before we get to, I'm curious to know sometimes the management practices that exist on forestry lands versus WMA lands and SNA lands, they don't always sync up. What kind of cooperation are you getting from wildlife with regards to being able to intensify the harvest, I'll say, of ash trees on WMAs and SNAs?
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, when we did our sustainable timber harvest analysis, that took into account all of the forested lands and included wildlife management areas. Our wildlife managers see the need to reforest ash forests as well. We have full cooperation with wildlife on our sustainable timber harvest.
Thank you.
Thank you, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, again, my name is Alexis Donath, Legislative Coordinator for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. MPCA works with our sister agencies, the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Agriculture, and the Environmental Quality Board on responding to the threat posed by emerald ash borer. We share the concerns expressed today. MPCA's role in EAB response is to identify ways to use or dispose of wood from EAB-infested trees. Members of this committee have heard the MPCA say before that there are three ways to deal with pollution: prevent it, manage it, or clean it up. Cleaning it up is almost always the most expensive solution. In the case of emerald ash borer, we do still have the opportunity to minimize and prevent waste by slowing the rate of spread of the disease and identifying markets that can use the wood from diseased trees. We approach this task according to Minnesota's waste management hierarchy. The goal of this hierarchy is to identify the most environmentally preferable waste management options that are appropriate for each situation and each material. So the ideal is waste reduction, that is, reducing the number of living trees that become diseased and controlling the rate of spread at a manageable level, followed by reuse, using the wood as a marketable resource, and then we look to recycling, composting, recovering energy, and finally landfilling. In the case of emerald ash borer, we also need to make sure that the wood is managed in a way that does not accelerate the spread of the disease. If EAB continues to spread, which it will, we need to have a variety of approaches to manage the volume of infested wood. One option is timber harvesting. As Director Bowe mentioned, in 2016, DNR directed foresters to increase the amount of ash in timber sales. In 2018, DNR's sustainable timber harvest analysis called for offering 15,000 cords of additional ash each year for the next 5 years. This wood is from forest stands. It is most likely destined for lumber, pulpwood, and firewood. Timber harvest is also practical for some large stands on golf courses or in public parks. However, timber harvest is generally not practical for boulevards or small stands of trees in community forests. A second option is to expand the use of ash in wood products. Even wood from EAB-infested trees is suitable for various products, including paper, flooring, and furniture. The wood accents in the photograph on the upper right of the slide are made of thermally modified white pine, but ash wood, including EAB-infested wood, could also be suitable for applications like this. Thermally modified wood treatments enable highly value-added uses for timber, and that includes wood affected by EAB. The University of Minnesota is working to develop other new opportunities to use ash material. Some Midwestern states have worked with the U.S. Forest Service to develop the Urban Wood Network, which is identifying community-based solutions to an abundance of ash wood. While we hope to minimize the spread of EAB and find marketable uses for ash wood, mulching and composting are the most viable outlet for the EAB wood for which there is not another purposeful use, including community wood waste. Existing permitted yard waste sites are probably the most flexible and easily expanded system for excess EAB waste. As of 2017, Minnesota has more than 124 compost sites that accept yard waste. All of these sites have the appropriate permits from the MPCA to accept ash tree waste. However, some of these facilities choose to limit the type, quantity, or size of wood that they wood waste that they accept. Landscaping businesses, woodlots, and so on accept EAB-infested wood within the working rules of the quarantine. However, these facilities may reach capacity during times when there is a high rate of ash tree loss within the local area. Compost site operators have received training regarding EAB quarantines, and they typically work with haulers and the public to comply with those regulations. In some areas of the state, excess wood supply can be received by biomass facilities. The Twin Cities area is fortunate to have two outlets for biomass energy for wood, District Energy in St. Paul and Coda Energy in Shakopee. If we are contemplating starting up new biomass energy facilities, we do need to keep in mind the complexity of biomass energy and that these facilities have long development periods. Minnesota has recently closed biomass facilities because of the long-term drop in fuel prices, which would make it very difficult for wood-based energy to compete in this market. Open burning of wood waste should be considered a last resort. Uncontrolled burning of wood contributes significantly to air pollution in Minnesota and is associated with negative health impacts, especially for vulnerable individuals such as the elderly and those with pre-existing health conditions. According to the Minnesota Residential Wood Fuel Use Report, ash is the second most common species to be burned as firewood in a residential setting in Minnesota. Infested ash trees can continue to harbor EAB after the wood is cut into firewood. However, if transported properly, spread may not be a concern. All of these options for managing ash wood require transporting and storing material until markets are available to take the product. It is difficult to predict the amount of material coming into the waste stream and demand for the product, so storage is currently a concern in certain parts of the state. As we learn from Dutch elm disease, large wood debris yards are prone to infestations of rodents and insects. Planning efforts must include geographically distributed locations for wood chipping, fuel preparation, and composting facilities. Coordinating the transportation of wood to the various processing facilities will be essential to managing ash wood waste in a way that is cost-effective and that minimizes the risk of spreading the disease to new areas. Next, I would like to turn it over to Director Bowe from DNR, who will conclude our presentation.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm batting cleanup here for the agencies, and just want to reiterate a couple of things. One is that you're going to see there's a lot of players at the table when it comes to EAB, and it's going to take all of us to bring all that we have to the table to combat this insect. And that includes the counties, it includes private woodland groups, it includes cities and industry and researchers as well. I want to reiterate that the immediate need is in our communities, and maybe down the road 3 to 5 or 7 years we need to do something in addition to our to focus on our ash forest. But right now, in the short term, it is with the communities, and I look at the communities as our first line of defense. So we have some recommendations. We need to continue our statewide coordinated slow the spread efforts, and that allows those costs to be absorbed over a greater period of time. We need to provide some financial assistance to the communities with an emphasis on the inventory, the planning, and the treatment, and then ultimately the removal and replanting of those community forests. And we need to develop a statewide approach to how to utilize ash and dispose of the ash as it comes into our waste stream. So with that, I think it concludes our presentation. We could take any additional questions, and if not, I think we'll probably move on quickly to Rob Slezak. Rob is with the Minnesota Forest Resources Council and is going to give us just a couple of minutes on the research that's been going on that he's been involved in.
Let's go ahead and do that, and then we got a couple questions. But let's wrap up the presentation here. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to come here and talk today about this really important issue. And so we've heard a bit about kind of the impacts for communities, and you hear a little bit more about that later today. But, of course, we're very much focused on the impact of forests. Step back for a moment. My name is Dr. Rob Slezak, Director of Applied Research and Monitoring at the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. So again, very focused on that forested impact. Minnesota Forest Resources Council is charged with trying to achieve broadly sustainability within the state, not just within state lands, county lands, federal lands, but across all lands. And so this issue is huge in terms of what the council views in terms of priorities and threats to the way in which our forests function. And it's reflected in the resources and the commitment they've done in terms of the work that I'm doing related to assessing this topic, and also with all the collaborators that we have listed here at the bottom of the slide that have been working on this work as well. All right, so the issue with black ash, and it is primarily black ash. So there's three species of ash within the state of Minnesota, but we're primarily concerned about it is black ash, and this is for two primary reasons. One is just an extensive amount of land area within the state, roughly about 1 million acres of our forested black ash wetlands, roughly about 5% of the state land area in total. But the more important part is that it's just a really unique type of ecosystem. So these are forested wetlands, and they're dominated almost entirely by that singular species, black ash. Historically, there might have been some other species present. Dutch elm in particular played a big role in these wetland forests, but obviously with Dutch elm disease, they're now limited down. And so the composition diversity of those wetland ecosystems is just generally pretty low. And so what we think of then is black ash is, kind of serves as a foundational role in which the way those ecosystems function. And if we lose black ash following EAB mortality, the impacts could be quite large. So the overriding objective of the research that we're working on, and really just all the efforts of the forestry community in general, is trying to maintain these forested wetlands in a forested condition. Trying to achieve what's shown in that picture on the left, a nice forest. In that case, it's an ash forest. Maybe in the future, it's composed of a different group of species, but maintain it in a forested condition and really avoid trying the outcome that's shown in that picture on the right, where you have more of an open water wetland, marsh-like condition, which doesn't have the functions and the resources, the benefits that we typically associate with forests. And so key questions is just trying to assess what those actual impacts are, and also trying to figure out if the forest can recover on their own, or if in some instances we might actually have to actively do some type of mitigation strategies in order to maintain those benefits. Now, we've done quite a bit of work over the last 8 years trying to assess this question, most of it funded by the Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund. But that work has largely been encapsulated in one of our biggest experiments has been the one that we have on the Chippewa National Forest, where we've gone out and actually manipulated forest conditions in order to assess some of these questions. So we've gone and actually simulated the effect of EAB. If you look at the slides there, the lower left-hand picture, we actually went out and girdled all the ash trees to simulate what the effect of EAB would be once it gets into our northern forested wetlands. And we've also done other treatments as well, trying to assess different management practices of whether or not we could mitigate in some way the impacts associated with that. And so, by and large, what we've seen is that the impacts are quite large. So these, I'm highlighting three of them here today. The first being the impact associated with water. So once you lose those ash trees, you lose the transpiration stream that's associated with it. You modify the microenvironment. And essentially what that does is it makes those wetlands much wetter. And you're converting from more of a forested periodically inundated wetland to more of a continuously inundated marsh-like condition. And so impacts not just on water quantity, but also impacts to water quality as well. When those changes to hydrology and water dynamics occur, it also is reflected then in vegetation. And so what we've seen from a lot of our data is the vegetation starting to reflect the wetter conditions. We have much more dominance of sedges, of grasses, and more lowland shrubs. And importantly, a really low amount of natural regeneration of trees. And so essentially what our biggest concern was is a lot of our experimental data now is showing directly that those impacts of the conversion from a forest to more of a marsh-like condition is occurring. And then lastly, the big one that we focused in on as well is wildlife. So black ash wetlands are actually wildlife hotspots. A wide range of wildlife species utilize them. And that's largely because of the structural complexity that's associated with the black ash wetland community. When you lose the black ash, you lose that structural complexity. And when that happens, you have impacts to habitat, and that directly translates to impacts to wildlife. So we know that the impacts are likely to be large now, but we've also been looking at ways of potentially mitigating some of those. And the biggest one we've been focusing in on is trying to do mitigation via planting of an alternative tree species. Right? So right now we have just that one dominant species within the forest. If somehow we can figure out a way to get other species established, and that can potentially grow into a forest in the future. We've been looking at a wide variety of different species. By and large, we haven't had the best success. The conditions in black ash wetlands are quite harsh. There's a reason why only black ash grows there now. And so trying to establish alternative species is challenging. With that said, we have had some good success with a handful of species, notably Dutch elm disease-resistant elm has had very good success, and also some other species such as swamp white oak. And so these are promising, but we need to figure out how to even improve the survival, growth, and utilize practices to enhance the establishment of those species so that we can grow the forest in the future. So it's a big issue. This map kind of encapsulates that. You can hear the million acres, but when you see it in a picture form, it's widespread, right? There's black ash wetlands spread all across the northern forested portion of the state. And so we do know those impacts can be large. It's going to be impacts, again, on water, vegetation, and wildlife. But at the same time, we do think there's a strong likelihood of being able to do some mitigation. But we need some more information in order to do that as effectively as possible. And so information related to, again, figuring out what some of those most suitable replacement species are going to be and how we can be more effective at getting them established, but also trying to assess what the long-term effect of these simulated EAV treatments are. You know, we know there's going to be impacts to water. We've already shown that over the last 8 years. But what happens in 15 years, 20 years? Really critically important question, because quite frankly, for a lot of these wetlands, we're not going to be able to do much with them. And so we really need to be able to understand what the impacts are going to be when we are unable to do some type of mitigation management. If we can get that information, ultimately it gets down to just coming up with a coordinated strategy. And speaking on behalf of the Forest Resources Council, with my role with that organization, the council is very engaged and willing to serve in trying to develop those collaborative networks, and really coming up with a comprehensive strategy in order moving forward to minimize the impacts on our forested wetlands in Minnesota. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you for the presentation, and we do have a couple of questions here, and we'll try and get through here, and then we have a number of other folks that want to give some testimony too. So I have Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am sitting here thinking about the loss of forests and what that means for climate change gases, and I'm thinking about the regeneration of forests and what that might mean and our vested interest in regeneration. But I didn't hear any analysis from any of you about how climate change is impacting or how we should be mitigating and adjusting. And it felt like a big gap in our thinking from PCA, from this, and I hope as we go forward we will have analysis that includes what we have to do about both preventing and adapting and mitigating.
I thought I heard a recommendation there, but go ahead, response, Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, you're right. We didn't focus on climate change, and we certainly can include more of that in future conversations. I think maybe what we did cover, though, was the idea that we've got a million acres of ash, and if we lose that and aren't thoughtful about replanting those areas, we'll have a million acres less forest on the landscape, and that clearly has an impact on climate change and our ability to sequester carbon and all of those things. So we're concerned about that. And then also, I think you heard just the idea that without those ash forests taking up all that water, it will change what those areas look like. And that water doesn't just stay on our land. It will move, and so it will have water quality and quantity kind of impacts.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that, but I want you to put numbers to it. Let us understand, both as legislators and the public, what these big changes are going to mean and analyze it in terms not just of forestry, but in terms of climate change. I mean, we need numbers.
Mr. Chair, I fully agree with you on that. And we haven't run the numbers in that in terms of like a net change in carbon balance. Obviously, if you lose a lot of that standing carbon in the wood, that's a huge loss. What we focus in on is kind of just trying to do that net wash, right? Where if we can at least get a forest established, you can maintain the carbon storage associated with that. And so the one thing we have focused in on is those replacement species. We've actually been looking at more southern adapted species in order to address future conditions. So more species that might be better adapted to a future climate. And some of the ones that have done pretty well are some of those southern species. So swamp white oak, hackberry are two of the ones that we've had good success with. And that's trying to at least address some of the issues related to climate change.
Let's talk about that. Okay. Three more questions, and then we need to move on if we can. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine will be pointed and quick. Two for the DNR, and I'll ask them both. First of all, how much time do we have to get this done before you guys believe that the bugs are going to get into the northern hemisphere of Minnesota? And the other is, how much time did this cold weather this year buy us?
Introduce yourself again.
Mr. Chair, I'm Angie Amborn. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm an entomologist, Mr. Representative. The numbers behind the cold weather, I mentioned that in my first few slides there. So at about minus 20, we start to see about 50% of the emerald ash borer die, and then that increases as we, you know, as the temperature drops. And then upwards of minus 30, that's where we see the 98% mortality. Keep in mind that, there are a lot of things that affect that. The wind chill does not impact the insects. Snowpack underneath the bark will insulate the insect. And like I said, so if we have those temperatures, what will happen was, you know, we'll have a certain percentage of those insects die. The population will get set back, but in how insect, you know, population dynamics work, insects can rebound very quickly. So it in effect will buy us a little bit of time, but like I said, it's not going to be a cure in terms of, you know, looking long term at emerald ash borer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but it didn't really answer my question because I know it's not a cure. I mean, I know that, but it's got to have given us a certain amount of time, and you must have some kind of a time that you think you have before you have to get, you know, I don't want to say serious because I know you're serious, but before you have to get these new trees in the ground and get these old ones out of there while they're still usable. So how much time are we looking at?
So I can only speak to the cold, and I'll let Forrest speak to the rest of it. Those cold temperatures will approximately buy us 2 years.
Okay. Mr. Bowe, did you want to add anything?
No.
So you don't really know how much, excuse me, Mr. Chair, you don't really know how much time we have, so we'll worry about that later. The other is for the MPCA. You talked about mulching and composting and also firewood, and you said that the emerald ash borer could live in the firewood for a certain amount of time. And you were going to quarantine the mulch, or, you know, the people that had the mulch. How long does it live in these conditions? Because if we use it for mulch and spread it around.
Mr. Chair, I can speak to that as well.
Please.
Mr. Representative. So emerald ash borer has approximately a 1 to 2 year life cycle, depending on where you are in the state. So at any point in time, the way that the life cycle works of emerald ash borer, you're going to have larvae underneath the bark. So there are overlapping generations within there. So at best, you have, you know, if the bark is on the wood, you're going to have at least, they can be in there for 2 years, up to three, if depending on how, you know, how it gets infested. So approximately 2 years. In the mulch, they have done research on that, and we have set specifications, which is, I believe, 1 inch by 1 inch in two dimensions, and that they have found that that's where, that's the amount that emerald ash borer can't survive in. And so that's why we've set those requirements for the mulch. Does that answer your question?
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe you said this, I think I've heard in previous testimony in previous years, because we've spent 10 years not doing anything. 10 years. So the first infestation was in 2009, and we appropriated $2 million out of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. The Outdoor Heritage Fund, which says it's to protect, restore, and enhance forests. And after we did that, then people got mad because it was their money, and we couldn't use that for that. But I seem to remember testimony that comparing how much money did we actually spend as a state, not as local government property taxpayers, but as a state on Dutch elm disease, and what is the inflation-adjusted amount, what would that be today in terms of, I seem to remember it was like $17 million back in the 70s, which would, and maybe these numbers are wrong because my memory gets a little fuzzy now, but what was the amount we spent in aggregate in the 70s as a state responding to Dutch elm disease, and what would that amount be today in equivalent dollars? If anyone knows that, maybe there's people in the audience that know it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think it's best for us to get that information back to you so we're not making a guess and being off by some millions of dollars. So we'll get back to the committee on that.
Please provide that, and then we'll disseminate that information.
Yep.
Representative Hansen.
So, Mr. Chair, are we going to have these folks back at any time? I know there's a lot of material we covered today, and we got more to go. But are we going to have another opportunity to talk to them about some issues? I think Representative Wilgini has brought up some questions relative to.
Perhaps by popular demand.
well, I'm going to go ahead and ask my question then, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
So, please.
Representative Wilgini, you brought up some questions in regard to climate change and so on and so forth. And I'm wondering, is there going to be any information available? I've got some folks asking me back home with the polar vortex, so to speak, impacting insects. It also, of course, is impacting plant species, tree species. Do we at some point maybe have some idea what that impact could be to our forests?
Mr. Ball.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, I think we'll have to get back to you on that as well. There's, you know, just a lot of impacts to any number of these issues. Certainly the forests are pretty well adapted to cold weather. But as we see our forests starting to change, we're not exactly sure how those species are going to fare. And so I think one of the things I would recommend is we get some of our researchers to tell us a little bit more about that and what they might predict for the future.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative McGinnis's question, I would just simply add, you know, one of the, I guess, side effects of global warming to some extent may be this polar vortex, which in Minnesota's case could mean that a number of the presentations and research that I've seen suggesting that we can plant more warm or moderate temperatured trees and plants further north, that may not be a good idea. We may need to be looking more closely at that before we make an investment that could cost us and wind up producing nothing.
Take your point there, Representative Heinzman. Thank you. And I'd remind members, you can request any one-on-one in your office with these experts, as it were. So let's do that. Thank you all for your presentation today.
Thank you.
And we're going to move forward with some testimony, and I've got some names here. Gina Hugo, Minnesota Forestry Association.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Gina Hugo. I'm a forester with the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District. I serve on the board of directors for the Minnesota Forestry Association, Minnesota's oldest conservation organization around since 1876. We've since been promoting wise stewardship on Minnesota's private forest lands through education and advocacy. I'm also active on the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee, which is Minnesota's tree board, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Soil and Water Conservation District Forestry Association. And the significance of listing these off is that collectively they represent Minnesota's forestry interests, from urban to small town to greater Minnesota, rural forest landowners to loggers to sawmills. And all three entities have identified EAB as an urgent priority in need of state leadership and funding. As a group of concerned stakeholders representing several organizations and citizens, our goal today is to provide information on the broad range of impacts that Emerald Ash Borer will have on Minnesota's towns, cities, tribal communities, forests, wildlife habitat, wetlands, rivers, and lake water quality, and to motivate legislative action that will result in state leadership and funding to help communities prepare for and mitigate the impact of all invasive forest pests. I think we could all agree in the room that Emerald Ash Borer is likely not to be the last invasive forest pest to launch on our communities. With that, I'm going to cut it short in the interest of time and segue into the next testifier. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hugo, and thank you for your time consideration. And we do have quite a few testifiers. I'd like to hold questions from members until we get all the testifiers can be heard. So please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for calling a hearing on this important topic. My name is Karen Zumach. I'm the Director of Community Forestry for Tree Trust, a Twin Cities-based nonprofit aimed at tree planting and employment training. I'm also the president of the 400-member Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee, a committee composed of public and private tree care professionals, interested citizens, nonprofit organizations from across the state, tasked with educating and informing all Minnesotans about the benefits of a healthy community forest. As Representative Hansen mentioned, this marks 10 years since EAB was confirmed in our state. After being discovered in 2002 in the area of Detroit, we knew it was just a matter of time before it would be found here in Minnesota. It is indeed what we call a predictable disaster. Ash trees make up 20 to 40 and in some places 60% of the trees that line our streets, shade our homes, and grace our public parks in Minnesota, numbers nearing 3 million across the state. The real threat EAB poses to our quality of life, to our environment, to our economy, and to the health of our state is far-reaching, leaving few environmental issues of concern untouched by impact. For the past 4 years, MNTAC has been working hard with others to bring awareness to this issue. We have been here in the legislature trying to make the case for funding for communities to manage EAB where it is so we can keep it out of where it isn't. We've tried hard to make it a priority with the agencies. There have been LCCMR proposals put forth by the DNR and the MDA, as well as a Lessard-SAMS proposal. We contend there is no reason Minnesota should be impacted by EAB in the same way the states before us have. There are tools available to our communities to assist in the active management of this pest. We can and must do better. What we need is the political will to invest in our urban and community forests in the face of this aggressive invasive species and beyond. As Director Bowe mentioned, communities are the forefront of this pest. It's imperative that we provide comprehensive access and encourage utilization of all the tools in the management toolbox. Inventory, planning, preservation of those high-quality ash trees, removal of those low-quality ash trees, and replanting the next generation of a diverse canopy. EAB does not recognize boundaries, and science has shown that comprehensive management not only reduces beetle populations, it reduces overall costs for communities and preserves the ecosystem services provided by these mature trees. A statewide source of funding for communities will provide access to these important tools and will facilitate an orderly transition away from an over-reliance of ash trees in our communities. I'd like to take you for a moment to a single ash tree standing on a street in front of a constituent's home. That tree is probably about 40 feet tall. It's about 18 inches in diameter, the average size of an ash tree in our urban and community forest. And that single tree is providing benefits to that homeowner, to the city, to the county, and to the state by mitigating stormwater runoff, conserving energy with its shade, sequestering and avoiding carbon, reducing urban heat island, and increasing property value. And it's doing all of that just standing there. It's one of the few pieces of infrastructure that cities and towns can invest in that actually increase in value over time. In short, big trees provide big benefit. To put those benefits into numbers, the Forest Service has created a tool that quantifies these benefits. For each 18-inch ash tree, The benefits include nearly 2,000 gallons of stormwater mitigated each year, an increase in property value for that homeowner of $45 per year, a reduction of nearly 1,000 pounds of CO2. With the additional benefits of energy conservation and air quality, the total benefits that that one tree is providing totals $165 per year. Multiply that by 3 million, and you can see how those benefits really add up. To understand what we lose if we don't invest in our community trees, we're talking about an additional 6 billion gallons of stormwater, impacts to our air and water quality, greenhouse gas goals, reduction in property values. It takes two generations to restore the canopy to pre-invasion levels after an invasive species. MNSTAC has seen this before. We know how this goes. We started back in the 70s during Dutch elm disease when Minnesota invested nearly $500 million in today's money to help manage Dutch elm disease, $30 million a year for each of the 6 years it was funded. What we are proposing today is a multi-pronged approach to assist in this battle. We ask that you support sustained urban and community forestry funding to protect our community forest from future pests and disease of at least $2 million per year. Provide assistance in the form of grants to cities and towns to access all the tools necessary in the toolbox to mitigate the damaging effects of EAB of at least $5 million per year. Continue to support the research conducted in the Northern Black Ash Swamps through the DNR, University of Minnesota, the MFRC, as well as within our tribal communities. And lastly, we ask that consideration is given to the way in which we assign state agency roles in regards to shade tree pests and disease. Currently, the task of identifying and delineating emerging pests is assigned to the Department of Agriculture until an unspecified time at which the pest is then deemed to be established. At that time, the responsibility is then transferred to the DNR. This lack of clear roles and responsibilities leads to decreased or delayed prioritization, resulting in seeming inaction. One thing is clear, the time is now. We need to manage this pest where it is so we can allow for the important research to continue. Research has come incredibly far since EAB was found in 2002, and we can manage this pest better. We have to. Thank you.
Thank you. Victoria Reinhart, I have on the list. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Victoria Reinhart. I serve on the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, and I am currently the chair of the Partnership on Waste and Energy, which is a joint powers board with Hennepin County, Ramsey County, and Washington County. And today I'm here to speak about the county issues and interests related to emerald ash borer. As I have listened to, and I know you will be listening to others as well, you're going to hear from state and local government, private entities, and associations with concern about emerald ash borer. And all of us understand the gravity of the epidemic and will speak to the urgency and action to address its consequences. Emerald ash borer kills ash trees, and all ash trees are susceptible and will be infested. Right now, there are 17 Minnesota counties that have infestations and resulting in quarantines being placed on the management of wood waste. The recent cold weather, we've heard about that, but it's a very short time frame that is going to really have an impact there because all of the ash trees will be infected, and as you've heard many times before. You've also heard about the fact that there are three categories of the issues related to EAB: tree removal, tree replacement, and wood waste management. And I'm here this morning to talk primarily on managing wood waste from the emerald ash borer. Counties are responsible, according to state mandate, for waste management and planning and assuring state goals are met, including tree waste. And for obvious reasons, we're very concerned about EAB, particularly the wood waste perspective. The emergence of EAB and the loss of trees is creating significant amounts of wood waste now and into the future. And we know that the volume of the wood waste will increase as the infestation of the emerald ash borer continues to march across the state. Preliminary analysis has shown that there are at least 2.9 million ash trees in the seven-county metropolitan area, all of which will succumb to the disease. These trees will result in over 1.67 million tons of wood waste requiring disposal. At present, there are only a few ways that this waste can be handled. One is the landscape mulch markets, which are nearly saturated and at present cannot absorb all the volume of wood waste that will result from EAB. Second is using the wood in making certain products, but the market for ash tree, ash wood in those markets cannot absorb the volume either. So at present, the use of wood waste in biomass plants, which produce energy for heating and electricity, is the largest market to manage this material. And I know you're going to be hearing from another speaker, actually right after me, about that issue. Please note that unlike the state's experience with Dutch elm disease in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, wood waste cannot be buried in landfills, nor can it be placed in solid waste, and open burning, of course, is not allowed. We believe that action is needed now to assure that wood waste is properly managed. That begins with the state leading a coordinated approach to the development of sound and lasting infrastructure for wood waste, and it should include that we need to address the economics of wood waste disposal and offer options for funding responsible wood waste planning and management. State grants, funding, and incentives are needed there. Development of innovative alternate private sector markets for products made from wood waste, especially in the urban area where such markets can also lead to more jobs. Further development of landscape mulch markets. Ensuring the continued use of existing biomass facilities that use wood and wood waste for energy productions. And to me, one of the most important is the investment in emerging technologies such as research and development going on at the U of M's Natural Resources Research Institute, and continuing to make efforts to contain the spread of EAB, including maintaining quarantines and education to allow for proper management of wood waste and responsible replacement of the lost trees. If we don't act now, we face an uncoordinated, reactive response. We can expect to see stockpiling of wood chips and wood waste, which is at risk for spontaneous combustion. We only need to look back a few decades to see what happened to the huge piles of elm wood in St. Paul, which burned and created hazardous smoke for months. Public and private collection of yard waste will be overwhelmed with EAB material from residents and communities, with few legal options to take the material. It is likely that there will be more backyard burning for disposal and the associated health risks in the urban and suburban area. Illegal dumping of ash wood onto public or private property will likely increase, and there will be calls for local and state government to create a solution in reaction to the mounting wood waste issue, which will be more expensive and less effective than a planned system, as we learned from the Dutch elm disease. Finally, we also know that other plant diseases are emerging, which will lead to even more wood waste resulting from damaged and dying trees. Counties are ready now to work with the state to move forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. We've got four more testifiers, and we'll try and get everybody in here. So we've got Ken Smith, and then Craig Johnson, Jeff Haberman, and Chao Zhang. Please go in that order, and be ready to come down quickly, or be seated back behind the testifying table, if you would. So, Ken Smith?
Yes. Mr. Chair, thank you, committee members. My name is Ken Smith. I'm the president and CEO of Evergreen Energy and District Energy St. Paul. And thank you for the opportunity to speak on this very important topic. Operational since 2003, the St. Paul Cogeneration Facility was developed in downtown St. Paul to assist the region with managing wood waste by turning it into renewable energy, a form of electricity that's sold to Xcel through the biomass mandate, and then through also to District Energy St. Paul, which is heating buildings, over 200 buildings in downtown St. Paul, including the Capitol Complex and the building we're in here today. Each year, we use approximately 260,000 tons of tree waste that's processed into biomass fuel and then is used to produce energy. Tree waste comes from local units of government, private landowners, businesses who need help with dealing with tree trimmings, brush, diseased trees, storm damage. And over the past 5 years, we have received tree waste from over 115 communities and 22 counties. And as you heard from Commissioner Reinhart, that material cannot be landfilled. And so we are serving a public purpose by turning this into a renewable energy stream. As emerald ash borer spreads, we have seen a steady increase in the volume of EAB that we're dealing with. In 2017 and 2018, we experienced a significant increase in emerald ash borer material, making up at times about 50% of the wood waste material that was generated in the metro area. And as you heard from Commissioner Reinhart, it's estimated there's about 1.7 million tons in just the seven-county metro. To give you an idea of how much that is, if that was all ground into wood chips and put into the largest tractor trailers we can use to move that material, it'd be over 75,000 tractor trailers. I would invite you. We had Senator Rood's committee from the Senate that toured our wood yard down by Pig's Eye, so it's very close to here. If you want to tour the facility, get a sense of what it takes, the scale, we certainly would make that available to you to get a scale and the scope of what it takes to handle wood waste. Minnesota is just beginning to deal with this devastating effects of this. It's clear that resources are needed for communities. They're challenged. And there's resources needed for the planning, for them to understand what to do and how to treat, but then also resources to deal with disposal. We've been a partner to agencies, state agencies, local units of government, business for 15 years, and we stand ready to continue to do so and utilize this waste material for an energy resource. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. For those of you who might not be as familiar with the organization, the League is the association that represents all the cities of the state. There are 853 cities in the state. 833 of them are members of the League. The others are all under 200 in population, and if they call us, we'll still help them. The testimony you've already heard covers a lot of the reasons why this is a big problem. I think what we need to kind of get into here at the end of the hearing is how big a problem and where are we at. And I just want to kind of run through what a city has to deal with as they look at this. So the first thing you have to know is, where are your ash trees? You got to have an inventory that tells you where they are. The second thing you have to do is assess those and figure out which ones are healthy, which ones are sick, which ones are dead. Then you have to come up with a plan for what are we going to do about that. Which ones are we going to take out? Which ones are we going to treat? Which ones are we going to wait and see what happens on? And then you have to either treat the tree, take down the tree and replace it, kind of do the we're going to get rid of everything and just start over. It can be a very, very difficult thing, and it will probably not be the same strategy on every street in your city. And all of that leaves out all the ash trees on private property that are within our cities. So it is a big deal. However, I guess what I want to get to, because it seems so big and so hopeless, is there's a reason we need to slow this. These trees play a massive role in our communities, everything from the aesthetics and property value. Compare your house sale value with nice mature trees in front of it to having some sticks that have a few leaves on the top in front of it and see how it goes. It's a big difference. Compare how people feel about living in the neighborhood, the safety issues. Compare the impacts of a rain event in your community. Obviously, we all know when it rains, if you're under a tree, you stay drier. If it's lightning, then you have a bad idea. But the idea being, that's holding a lot of water. That's preventing it from being a stormwater issue, which many of you know is a major challenge for our cities right now. And losing tree canopy will make it much, much worse, especially as we see rain events that are getting larger and larger. So this is a big deal. and we are going to see impacts of it. Another impact of losing tree canopy is increased cooling costs. You lose the shade from the tree, now you have to cool your house more or your business more than you used to without the shade hitting your tree in the summer, the shade hitting your building in the summer. I guess the last thing, you're going to hear from cities with exact numbers and stuff. I don't want to get into all of that, but we did have a major partner from the state of Minnesota when cities were dealing with Dutch elm disease in the 70s. At the time, it was in the $20 to $30 million a year range, which is a much bigger number now, but we don't have that this time around. Cities are having to figure out what they can do on their own. Some cities have been able to put together a good program. They maybe already had an urban forester as part of their park system, maybe had a bunch of them. Many others do not have that luxury. They're sitting there waiting, and if we don't slow this down, they're going to be taking hundreds and thousands of trees in a given year, whereas if we can slow it down, it's dozens or scores of trees in a year, and these are thousands of dollars each to deal with. So it's a massive financial difference if we can slow this down, spread out the impact over a longer period of time, much more manageable. So we're just here today to lay the groundwork that we're going to need the state as a partner on this if we want any chance of being successful on this, and I think that's the case we're all trying to make for you today. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Jeff Haberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Haberman. I'm the city forester in Rochester, and I just want to thank you for allowing me to share Rochester's story. As you can see by my first slide, we're a population of about 115,000 people, and our canopy cover citywide is about 25.5%. Now, we know that ash comprises about 15% of the canopy citywide, and so without that component of the forest, we will be looking at about 21.6% canopy cover, which is a dismal number. Now, in Rochester, we have an EAB management plan. EAB was discovered outside our city limits in 2015. We approved our plan in 2016, and it's a 20-year plan, which is estimated to cost the city $5.5 million. At that time, we didn't have a complete inventory, and we didn't know how many ash trees we had in natural areas. So we did a lot of inventory work in 2016 in the winter and discovered we have about 2,500 more trees to deal with, which would add another half to that total cost. So my best prediction is it will cost about $7.5 million to the city of Rochester alone. Somebody had mentioned the time frame, and we know from history of other communities dealing with this that from the time you first find it, you have 8 to 12 years roughly. Someone else earlier showed the EAB mortality curve, and that's as the insect population builds, you lose more trees, and it does not take very long before every single tree is dead unless you treat the trees. So our plan includes treating trees. We plan to treat about 3,000 trees. That was roughly half of the trees that we had on streets and boulevards. We also plan to replace trees while funding lasts. We asked for an increase in staff in our management plan, and so far we've added two positions to help deal with that. And currently our ash population is just under 7,000 trees that we will have to deal with. Our treatment program includes, as I mentioned, treating trees on public property, but a portion of those are only being treated just to keep them alive. Someone mentioned that you can get overwhelmed with removals, and that's as the mortality, as you move up the mortality death curve, you get to a point where you can't keep up anymore. And so 1,100 of those trees are going to be treated just to keep them alive. We also allow treatments on private property. We allow residents to treat public trees if they want. We only prescribe or recognize emamectin benzoate. That is the injectable chemical that was talked about earlier. It is a non-neonicotinoid, and we make the arborists, the burden of the determination of whether a tree is treatable is put on the arborist that someone would hire to treat their tree. And I want to emphasize that treatment's a tool. There's been a lot of talk about benefits that trees provide.
I used a 20-inch ash tree. That's about the average size ash in Rochester. And you can see that it provides about $179 in annual benefit. And that's important. We do our treatments in-house with city staff. And we can, and that treatment cost is about $5 per inch. So you're looking at about $100 to treat the tree. And by the label, that's effective for 2 years. But there's good research to show you can stretch that out to 3 years and not lose trees, making it even more cost-effective. This information came from the National Tree Benefit Calculator that someone else mentioned earlier. Now, here's what's happening in Rochester. I was fortunate enough to get sent to Michigan in 2007, shortly after it was discovered there, and you saw this wholesale tree mortality. I mean, wooded areas that were completely dead from EAB. This picture is actually Rochester. And so we're experiencing that already in just a short amount of time. But in terms of tree mortality, the dark blue is public trees that we've removed, and the light blue is private trees. So in 2015, we removed 54 trees preemptively. 2016, the number of trees confirmed rose to 428 trees. In 2017, 1,045. And then this winter, we marked 1,800 trees for removal. I would mention that of those 1,800, 1,100 of them are on private property. So there is a great burden to private property with regard to EAB. This is just a representation of the trees that were marked for removal over that three-year period, so you can kind of see how it moves. It moved from the southwest quadrant, which would be the lower left part of the map, is where we first discovered it, and you can see as the progression of years goes how it's radiating out in all directions. This is the distribution of removals of trees that we marked on private property from this year alone. We didn't have the capability to track these trees previous to this year, but I mention this because it's increasingly becoming a burden on the city of Rochester in that we're having to finance the removals on private property for residents who can't afford them. So in 2017, the city had to finance $93,000 worth of tree removals, and last year, $79,000 worth of removals. We do have a program that helps them, and so if the cost of the removal is $1,000, they have to pay for it the next time their taxes are due. If the cost is between $1,000 and $5,000, they get 3 years to pay for it, and if it's over $5,000, it's a seven-year plan. So essentially, they'll divide that cost by seven, and each year they have to pay that much if it's over a $5,000 amount. And this is just a shot showing all the trees that we marked this winter, starting in November with our inspections. Green symbols are private property removals, and red symbols are public property removals. So it is a significant problem throughout our entire city already. Now I just want to share how this has been a burden on city staff. This is a look at how our staff time has increased. In 2015, we had... 849 staff time hours. In 2016, that rose to 965 hours. Then there was a big jump in 17 up to 2,917 hours, and this past year, 3,048 hours. That jump is largely due, our plan was predicated on the fact that we would contract out everything in order not to diminish the services that we already provide to the public, tree pruning, tree planting. But what we retained in-house was inspections on both public and private property and injection of our trees. And so the increase in time is largely the increase in time it takes us to inspect the entire city, and also the more trees we treat, the more time that we invest in it. City expenditures have followed. In 2015, we spent $23,000. In 2016, that went up to $63,000. In 2017, $172,000. Last year, we spent $266,000. And already this year, we've spent $190,000 on EAB management alone. To date, we've spent over $700,000. This is just the city of Rochester. And then... the next thing I just wanted to cover is the budget forecast. The purple column is what we've requested. The blue column is what's been allocated, and the green column is the actual costs or estimated costs. And so in 2019, we actually had some money left in CIP to carry over, so that's why that the light blue in 2019 is a little bit more. But our city administrators feel that they've capped what we can spend on EAB at $275,000 for the next 3 years. And the requested amounts were $350,000, $450,000, and $600,000, respectively. So we are going to be facing a major burden in trying to deal with it. And then finally, just my observations and recommendations on what cities need. We need complete tree inventories. We need to be able to develop management plans and help with that. We need money to protect trees, and a coordinated state effort would be extremely helpful to target where we can maximize the money that we spend. We also need to develop alternative wood markets. The debris stream is already unsustainable, and so finding other ways to use this wood besides grinding it up are extremely important. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. We have one more person to give testimony here, and I have Rachel. Please
yes.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Rachel Coyle. I am the city forester for the city of St. Paul. I have been coordinating the EAB management program in St. Paul since 2009 when EAB was first discovered in the state and in the city. The city began aggressively managing for this pest almost immediately and has continued to do so since then. Over that time frame, we've spent over $11 million on the program, and we estimate that another $27 million will be needed in order to complete the EAB management in St. Paul. We still have over 21,000 ash trees on city property, and this is including only the trees that we think will need to be managed, not those that are in natural areas or the river corridor that we would not need to do any work on. These numbers don't include anything on private property in St. Paul. They do not include the loss of benefits that the trees that we are removing provide, and they do not include the impacts to our general forestry maintenance programs that we have seen over the last 10 years. Today, we are removing entire blocks of ash trees that are infested throughout the city. Despite our aggressive management, the infestation has spread citywide, and we continue to remove ash trees that are dying from EAB. This has a significant aesthetic impact to communities, and I think that it's something that is sometimes overlooked, but being a city forester, I do need to communicate with our citizens that, it's a tough thing to go through, but the city landscape is really going to change once this goes through. Right now, we have concerns for public safety and for the safety of our forestry crews who are removing ash trees because they are dying faster than we can remove them. I think that any funding for EAB management in the state and in the communities would be helpful at this time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We've gone over our time here. I don't know if anybody's got a burning question that for any of the testifiers, we'd certainly try and accommodate that. But seeing none at this time, I want to thank everybody for coming and giving us your wisdom today and how we can proceed with a very serious issue. So thank you all. We stand adjourned.